Okay, thank you. Welcome everyone to the Arizona State Hospital Independent Oversight IOC committee meeting on June 15th. We will begin at 6:01. We have committee members Kay, myself, Chuck, Melissa, and Dee. Anyone else from the committee join since we checked a few minutes ago? Okay, so let's go ahead and begin. Before we begin, do we have anyone that needs disclosure or conflict of interest? And if so, please state why.
This is Dee. I have to look at the meeting minutes, but I am sure that there's some conflict for me. Hold on just a second. I'm just walking back to my computer to double check because I didn't fill out the form because I didn't think about it. So hold on just a second. Actually, it looks like I'm okay this month.
Okay. Okay, if something comes up and you feel there is a conflict of interest, please state it and then abstain from voting. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah, I don't see anything. Sorry.
Okay. Last meeting, did everyone have an opportunity to review the meeting minutes? And can I call for a motion to approve if there are no edits?
Motion to approve.
Okay, that was Chuck.
I'll second that. This is Dee.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
So moved.
Aye.
Okay. I'm not sure if there are any other IOC members on from other IOCs. If there are, and they'd like to update, give us an update from their IOC meeting, now's the time. Okay. Review of action items. So our only request in our last meeting was we asked about the number of complaints that or grievances that are successful or if they're downgraded to complaints. So the hospital did send that information. Let me see real quickly if I can get that at a point. I don't know if I can share. Here it is. So I'm looking to see. This is a time period for June 1st, 2022 to June 5th, 2023. The whole facility, so all and all units. So complaints, there are currently 7 open and 347 closed. Grievances, there are 7 open currently and 113 closed. So then down below it says resolved, substantiated versus decisions. Let me see if I see a legend everywhere. Okay. Here. They closed 4 of those complaints were substantiated or substantiated in part. During the same period, the office closed 113, 2.7% of those were substantiated. So anywhere between 2.7 to 4% of grievances have been substantiated. So do the committee members have any questions about that? Because I know that was a discussion last time.
I find that number pretty low. This is Kay on the SAGO unit. I filed my second grievance of all times, and they had said it was unsubstantiated, even though I provided, I thought, reasonable evidence, and they just said that they didn't substantiate it. I can give more details if you'd like.
I think that if it was for yours personally, then probably not.
Okay.
But again,
Lori?
This
is Lisa. I just wanted to share that the committee had asked for as much information going back as far as we can. This is what we have available in this format for Tableau, and we thought it was pretty representative of our process. Mm-hmm. So when we get an allegation from a patient on either campus, civil or forensic, it's determined to either be a complaint or if it meets the standard for a grievance from a patient who's been designated as familial, we We review records, we interview patients, we interview staff members. If appropriate, we review video, all of the medical records. And then what we're looking for is evidence that the allegation is, of course, substantiated. Sometimes they are substantiated in part. Many allegations are either withdrawn or just determined to be unsubstantiated. But when they're unsubstantiated, it doesn't necessarily mean there's no satisfaction for the patient, because there's many times when we're able to just provide information validation to the patient. And many times there's some level resolution, even if the complaint allegation or the grievance allegation isn't substantiated.
Okay. Thank you for the explanation. The other thing that's interesting is that there's such a high number here that are withdrawn. So, and this is conjecture, is it because it's heat of the moment, someone's forming a complaint and then later they withdraw it? The complaints, it seems to be a higher number than.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes patients will either be just kind of in a delusional state or a state of real discomfort, and they'll submit a complaint. Our team interviews them at least once, and often more than once if they want to be sure that the patient wants to withdraw it. And those also go to the committee that reviews all complaints and grievances. That same review committee also reviews a withdrawal. So sometimes there's something we can learn or something we want to follow up on, even if a patient has withdrawn their complaint. But yes, there's a very high number of withdrawals every week.
Okay. Any other questions from any committee members?
So this, I just wanted to.
Find that number very low. I guess I don't understand. Are these grievances that are being taken back, quote unquote, being done by the patient? Is that correct?
Are these complaints and grievances, they're submitted by the patient?
They're either submitted by the patient or by an individual on behalf of the patient. Anybody can submit a complaint. So sometimes Tara will submit a complaint or grievance on a patient's behalf. The majority are submitted by the patient. They can be submitted by the patient's guardian or even by a staff member who has a concern or wants something investigated. But the majority
withdrawn. How are those withdrawn? Are those withdrawn by the patients themselves who've already filed those complaints, or
always
those complaints always were filed by somebody else?
No, they are always withdrawn by the person who submitted them. So if a patient submits a complaint, the only way they're withdrawn is if the patient submits it. And our team makes very certain that they have the opportunity to be heard. And if they want us to follow up on anything, we make sure they understand their rights before we withdraw it. And then we still have a record of it.
Okay.
I think the administration shared last time when the committee was concerned where we felt we found substantiating evidence that there was retaliation against the patient, that we looked into their records for a long period of time. And even though we felt it was a violation of their human rights and that they were retaliated, it was found to not meet that level. And I think, Lisa, didn't you share what they had to meet in order to be substantiated at the level that the hospital is looking for? And what we thought was retaliation wasn't found to be retaliatory behavior when the hospital was evaluating that.
That's right. And then at the request of Access, we opened that investigation a second time to look at some additional information that Access requested us to look at. And we did not have really any evidence that we could identify retaliation. It was more just a subjective discussion between and records from the treatment team. that patient had the right then after our second review to appeal it. And my understanding is that has been appealed to Access.
Okay. Okay. Any other questions about this data? Okay. Then I'll stop sharing it. Thank you. And so I don't look like I'm not paying attention. I'm going to turn my camera off for a moment. Okay. So next, that was our review of our action item. Any previous or ongoing discussion? I think the one about our displeasure at the unsubstantiated review that we did, I think Alice felt after last month that we had done as much as we could. And at this point, we were just moving on and we'll look into it again, other instances that they come up. Now, Ash, administration update.
Yeah, hi, Lori. Hi, everybody. This is Mike. So the major update I have for the committee is, as promised, I'm pleased to introduce the hospital's new chief medical officer, Dr. Calvin Flowers. He is on the call tonight and will be joining us moving forward. Dr. Flowers started with the hospital on May 30th, so about 2 weeks ago, and he's very quickly getting up to speed on all the hospital's operations and the nuances of how the facility operates, our admission, discharge protocols, treatment regimens, so on and so forth. So we're very happy to have him, and I promise that we're just going to ease him in to the hospital's process. It can be very overwhelming, almost like drinking from a fire hose. But he is here and we're very happy to have him.
Thank you, Michael. I appreciate that. And hello, everybody. And it's nice to be here.
Well, thank you. I'm glad that you have come to Arizona State Hospital. They absolutely need your care and expertise. So look forward to seeing patient care and improvements. And I'm glad that you have a lot of experience in other psychiatric hospitals so you can bring the best of what you've seen and tell us about other things that can be improved and also things that are working really well, in your opinion.
Thank you. Definitely will.
Okay, anything else, Mike, from the hospital?
Not that I can think of specifically, Lori, but I'm sure some things may come up as we're proceeding through the agenda.
Okay. Okay. Well, as I know, as the administration knows, we were trying to have some Google Meet meetings with the patients, but it was a little snafu. But in addition to that, one of our two members that was available to do it at the last minute had a migraine and couldn't join. So even had it worked, it wouldn't have been permitted. So we'll try again. I think for the patients that are on, and Kay, if you talk to the patients, requesting the Google Meets will take more coordination than just us finding someone else, another committee member, to say, hey, do you have time tomorrow at this time to call patients? So we'll try
Lisa, yeah. And I really do apologize, particularly to Barbara and Dee. We believed we had everything set up and we are able to do Google Meets one-on-one with patients and committee members. I think there was just a breakdown that Tara and I hadn't anticipated. The unit was anticipating a phone call because that's what they've become accustomed to with the committee, but we absolutely can do Google Meets. And of course, as we've discussed, we're very eager to have committee members come on site and meet in person with our patients as well. But Tara and I will make sure that that doesn't happen again. We'll be on the unit if there's a scheduled call. If we don't have direct coordination with somebody that's making it happen. So my apologies for that.
I did have one patient come to me and complain that they had an IOP Google Meet scheduled and waited for over an hour. So yeah, we should try to make sure that that doesn't happen again.
I think that Dee also was on the Google Meets waiting, and she notified me, and then I notified administration. But sadly, even if it was able to work, you can't have just one IOC member on the in a meeting. So that could, it wouldn't have been permitted anyway. And I think I was flying during the time or at the airport ready to get on a plane, and there were no other members that were available. It was unfortunate that a member got ill, but hopefully next time. And I think for me, when I plan to come in for the forums, it's also a good time maybe to stay after and meet with the patients while we're planning to be there. I mean, when I'm in town, I'm more than willing to if other people can. And if not, we'll try the Google Meet. And if that fails, then we'll go back to phone calls until we can get more of our members that are available. But again, tell the patients that we haven't talked to that they are on the list. I did send around a message asking if anyone had time in the next few days, and I'm still waiting to see if anyone does.
Lori, Lori, out of curiosity, is the IOC getting much communications from the civil patients asking for sit downs or conversations? Or is it mainly from the forensic side?
Not recently. I mean, okay. I can tell you years ago, I would be on the civil campus as much as the forensic. I had never been on forensic campus until a couple of years ago.
Okay.
And we would go on civil, and the civil patients would ask to meet with us. Okay. But it seems like it's been quieter on the civil side lately. Maybe Tara could remind them that they have, you know, if they want to talk to us, we're there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there should be a good balance between civil and forensics and the interaction with the IOC. So I don't like it when it just kind of heavy on one side versus the other. Make sure that there's a good balance there across the campus. So if we can help in any way, just let us know.
And I think when we were on site more and we would go into one of the unit conference rooms, they would just bring, you know, on the civil side, they would just bring the patients in. We talk to them in a conference room, and then they go to get someone else.
Oh.
So maybe if we did more of that, like we're going to go visit Ironwood Day Room or something, you know, not day room, but a conference room in Ironwood, and tell all the patients that we'd be there on a certain day, maybe that could re-engage the civil side.
Yeah, definitely. And I really like your idea about potentially kind of coordinating with our patient forums. You guys maybe hanging back for a half hour or an hour afterwards, and because that way the patients are right there anyway. So that may make it more efficient for those meetings to take place.
Okay. That sounds good. Oh, the civil, one of the forums was just canceled. Why was that?
I think for a while we just had like duplicate. We're transitioning the calendars, and our objective right now is to do a forensic forum every quarter and one on civil every quarter. So we're making sure that happens, but I think we just had some doubled up.
Okay. So you guys will let us know when the next one is scheduled.
Absolutely, both civil and forensic, you bet.
Okay. As far as incident and accident reports, I just pulled a few. Let me see. For this one, it was ASH 2023-1899. And it was a patient that was escalating, and the patient ended up eventually having to be restrained. And as they were going to seclusion, the their belongings were, they went through belongings of the patient, and there was a lot of money. The patient had a lot of money, and it was interesting because they thought it was really a lot of money, and they were trying to get, they were trying to understand what is the maximum amount of money that a patient can have. And they were told it was $100, and anything over $100 they had to take back and put to the bank. And this was also a patient that seemed, I think there could be a language barrier also, from what I was reading. So is that correct? Can patients have up to $100 on their persons if they have that money?
Lisa, you can chime on this one. I think that may be correct. I think it's more patient specific or individualized. Some cannot have that much, others can. You are correct about this individual has a, there's a language barrier that we are working with, that we have historically worked with the state contracted language line to assist with translation services. But once in a while, this patient does not want to interact with them or our employees.
No, okay. Thank you. The next one, which was a bit out of the ordinary, was ASH 2023-2089, and it was an attempted AWOL. But if I read this correctly, it was an AWOL from ValleyWise, when the patient was over at ValleyWise for medical care or an appointment. The patient tried to go to the exit the facility, and their ValleyWise security intervened and provided a chemical restraint and put the patient in restraints at ValleyWise, and then called and coordinated with ASH administration to make sure that they had the order to transport in the TSD uppers and lowers based on the AWOL. Demonstrated AWOL behavior.
Yeah. So this is this is going to be weird for me to say this, but this is really the way that this definitely should happen, because the individual, even though they are admitted to our facility for treatment as one of our patients, when they're in ValleyWise, they're technically under their licensed care. So our staff cannot go hands-on with the patient while they're over there. It's a licensing violation. So having ValleyWise's staff intervene in the situation is actually the legal way that this should have taken place.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's what, was this patient a known AWOL risk?
To my knowledge, no, not prior to this event.
Okay, thank you. The other one, let me look where I was looking. Gosh. Oh, this is a more unusual ASH 2023-2199. And it was a patient that ended up barricading themselves in a bathroom, and then there was some self-harm being demonstrated, and I think there was a code gray called, and they were trying to respond and open a door, but the patient was also blocking the door, so someone advised that engineering needed to help with the door, and the engineering came down with the key to open the door, and they still couldn't get it, but someone else knew that there was a special tool to help unlock the door and pull the door open from the patient. They had to go get that outside in their car. So was it like taking the door off the hinges or something different than a key?
No, it's essentially a specialized key specifically for those doors. They're anti-ligature lock sets. So there's a special way to reconfigure, not reconfigure, but manipulate the lock so that we can gain access if a situation like this does happen.
Why wouldn't those be on the unit instead of out in a car?
That's a great question. I don't know. We will follow up on that. It's not, to my knowledge, I think they probably in the IR, they use the wrong term, specialized key. I think it's more of a tool that they use, like a tool like a maintenance man would have on them, but we can re-verify that.
Okay. And the rest, majority of the incidents, again, seem to be more typical, which, and by that I mean patients that are known to be people that try to self-harm, a lot of similar incidents. What I was trying to see in here was a lot of times when there's cool grays called or events called, it will say in the RM codes, no injury. So a lot of times there is no injury in these calls, even if sometimes it's self-inflicted injury, but then there isn't a injury that needs medical attention. Maybe, but once in a while you see one that is, I don't know, that definitely would need medical attention if there's a laceration or others. I wish it was easier to see. I was just trying to get a feel for how many of these incidents every month, since I get it in a big PDF and they're not sequential in numbers, it's always hard to get a feel for how many really are resulting in need for medical attention. That'd be a nice report.
Yeah, no, Lori, I can actually give you the number right now. Approximately 85% of all of the assaults that we have on campus result in no injury or no requirement for medical intervention. The ones that do are fairly minimal. It may be an aspirin, an ice pack, something along those lines. And Lisa can clarify this or reinforce this, but it's minimal, maybe 1-2% require the individual to actually go to, like, let's say Valleywise, if it's a patient, for medical care, or to Concentra, which does workplace, like for our staff, if they get injured. So it's a very minute number.
Yeah, it is a very low number, and that is something that we track on two different committees. So we have a harm reduction committee that meets every other month and includes all of the treatment teams, primarily on the civil side. And they're looking at assaultive behavior, self-harming behavior, and most recently also choking risks. So that harm reduction committee is looking at that data and tracking that for action steps that will result in reduced harm. But our rate of injury or any type of event that requires, even first aid, as Mike said, is low, but that requires medical attention is very, very low, fortunately. And I think that speaks to a lot of the training that our staff have and the effectiveness of their de-escalation and hold techniques.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. The other thing that always seems to be interesting or of note is that some of the patients that end up having repeated incidents, it appears, and I'm not doing it by numbers, but they can be on line of sight or COS or LOS. And sometimes it seems like there's more than one person with them, and then they still will have kind of escalating behavior that results in them assaulting the staff that's assigned to be one-on-one or two-on-one with them.
Right, and there's a very fine balance there, and as I'm sure everyone knows, as far as, you know, we've identified the individual is presenting a risk to either themselves or somebody else, and we want to make sure that we're giving them the least restrictive level of care, but still maintaining their safety. So the one-on-one is, or the close observation is warranted, but depending on their behavior, putting a staff on them unfortunately, is, you know, kind of giving them an easy target, which is unfortunate. There's mm-hmm. no real good way to have a balance there. We don't want them to be unobserved and potentially, you know, self-harm. But mm-hmm. how finding that finite balance is very difficult for any kind of facility that deals with patients with the level of acute illness that we have at the state hospital.
And for those, again, they shared the, let me show you real quick. This is the assault perpetrators. And as you can see, you can make it a little bit bigger. It seems like it's almost, and this is coded to protect the identity of the patient. I'm sure this is just a sequential number, non-identifiable, but except for the hospital. But you can see some patients are patient on staff and some are just patient on patient. And it seems like it's almost, if I'm eyeballing it, it's like 18 of one type and 20 of another. But again, a few patients tend to dominate these assaultive perpetrators.
Yeah, you're totally spot on, Lori. And I don't remember the exact number off the top of my head, but it's something along the lines of, Lisa, jump in if I'm wrong when I say this, and I apologize. It's about 10 to 12 patients are responsible for more than half of the assaultive behavior. So it's a very kind of like it's a very limited patient population that we're heavily focused on. The remaining, you know, 90% of the patients, they just got their heads down. They're trying to go through programming, do what's right. But there's that small subset that is having the behavioral assaultive aggressive behavioral issues.
That's exactly right. And some of these patients are pretty chronically on a list of highly assaulted patients, but others kind of cycle. So you might have somebody at the top of this list for a week or 2 weeks or a month, and then things will kind of transition and they'll be doing really, really well for a while. So it's not always that same group, but it is definitely a percentage. And depending on whether we're and we've got the ability to look at this data by unit and by date range. So, you know, whether we're looking at a month's time or a fiscal year or just the past week, there's obviously differences, but that's some of the tools that quality and the committees use to work with the unit staff and the treatment teams to help them identify, you know, where the work is.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. Any questions from the committee on any of what the hospital just shared with us and I shared with you? Okay, going back to, again, some other things that were coming up. We have had times in the past, and I'm not sure, because I definitely don't know your staff well at all, or any of them other than people that I've seen over the years. And I visit the facilities that seem to be the same security people and others. But it seems like sometimes some operators tend to answer the phone quickly and others don't. So there's times that we've been trying to get hold of the hospital or the IOC and it will ring a long time. I know Melissa's been on many a time, but we were like, oh my goodness, will they answer? And then you have other times that they answer right away. Now, I know that there's a gentleman that, and I don't know who he is or if there's only one. So I mean, I just know it's a male voice and he tends to answer promptly. And I don't know why sometimes, you know, I'm trying to tie it to this shift change or what's going on, but really long time to answer that.
So that gentleman you're speaking of, he's Jason, and he's no longer here at the hospital, and he was prompt, and so was Debbie. I've gotten to know quite a few of the operators, and some of the operators I've seen actually out on the mall wandering around talking to patients when they should be answering the phone, and I've experienced long wait times. That was actually the grievance I filed. I've gotten to the, my family members have gotten to the point where they don't even call into the hospital anymore because certain operators don't pick up and they don't want to wait on hold for 5 to 10 minutes to get through. So they just wait for me to wait the 5 or 10 minutes to, you know, get through to them. And it's really kind of frustrating. I listed the times in my grievance to let them know what, you know, shift that they can correlate, you know, the operator to. I have a pretty good idea who the operator is, but I'm not going to mention that person's name. And even at one point, I decided to wait her out. I sat for, I think, almost 15 minutes and she answered the phone and she actually sheeshed me. She was like, sheesh. And I was just like, oh my God, I just got done waiting 15 minutes to get somebody on the phone and you're going to sheesh me. I couldn't even believe it. I at that point, that's when I filed the grievance, but they unsubstantiated it because they said that I was unable to provide the times that my sister had tried to call. And I said that I'd provide my sister's phone number so that they can talk to her directly because it's harder for me to get pen to paper and stuff because of the way that the hospital checks out our pens to us and stuff. And so I had offered that and they said no, they wouldn't make external calls to family members. So at that point, they just said it was unsubstantiated and closed the claim.
Well, I don't know. I mean, just from times we typically try to call, it's usually afternoons. I mean, but we'd have to go back and look at our times that, you know, have, I guess we could take better note, but I would think that hopefully somehow, even if they're in the mall or wherever they happen to be, if they're called out of that, someone would be able to answer the phones.
So that's correct. And so I did sit down a while ago, probably less than a month or so ago with Kay to speak about this. And I'm still looking into it. I apologize. I haven't kind of finalized what's going on yet. But someone should always be on the phones because if, you know, even if the operator, and I'm not by any means denying what Kay is saying, that she saw the operator on the mall, somebody should be in that room because they need to be there to dispatch for emergency services. So I definitely want to follow up on this and make sure that we're doing everything that we're supposed to be doing.
Okay. And speaking, another subject that often comes up with phones, I mean, this amplifies the patient's feeling that they don't have enough time to talk to their families. And anyone that's complained to us has said they understand that they can't be using the phones during programming time, but they still would like to be able to use the phones when there isn't ongoing programming going on. Because if your family's on the East Coast or if you're having long wait times with operators and then everyone's, you know, trying to jam in 2 hours or so, it just doesn't work well for lots of people.
So I was told yesterday, and I didn't get more details on it, but I was told that they did change the phone hours. I don't know, Kay, has that been communicated yet to everybody? I don't know the exact times that they changed.
Effective July 1st of 2023, the phones will be open from 3 to 11. So that's gonna, I think, greatly help with the amount of traffic that's, you know, happening so that we're not bunched into 2 hour lots. I think that's going to be pretty helpful. So that starts July 1st and it'll be from 3 to 11 p.m. and then also the 11 to 1 p.m.
Okay, good to know. Thank you.
So that's good news. So I know this has been a long, persistent request of the patient. So thanks for opening the lines up. The other thing I was going to ask too, on, you know, when I read through accident and incident reports, sometimes it will mention if they're temp staff or not, or they mention that company you mentioned, Concerta, or something like if someone is assaulted.
That's Concentric and At Work. Those are the two staffing agencies that I've dealt with here at the hospital or I've seen.
Yeah, that's Concentric. I don't think I've seen the other one. But is the hospital getting back to a better staffing? And you know, staffing's a problem everywhere. So I'm not pointing this out. As you all know, even at Valleywise and others, people are having trouble keeping staff. I'm not sure what level of staff, what positions are hardest, but are.
Yeah, so right now, Lori, obviously, like, and I think you said it perfectly, every other hospital, healthcare facility in the country is struggling with staffing. It's a industry-wide labor shortage. And there's, because of that, there's significant wage inflation taking place across the entire care continuum. So the state hospital right now, we are looking for behavioral health technicians and registry nurses. Those are our two kind of main areas of need. And I think that's kind of synonymous throughout the mental health industry, at least at this point. When it comes to staffing levels, though, you know, and we've discussed this before in this meeting and in just kind of one-on-one conversations. So the hospital uses what's called an acuity-based staffing program, where our staffing needs or our levels of needed employees will fluctuate day to day based on the patient's acuity. So one day the hospital may need, and I'm just going to ballpark numbers here, the hospital may need 105 staff members, specific 105 total behavioral health technicians and nurses to operate as normal as designed. The next day, that number may drop to 95 if the patient acuity drops and we have fewer, you know, fewer one-on-ones or fewer close observations. Right now, as of today, we are able, like, let's say I'll just use a round number for simplicity's sake. Let's say if we need 100 employees on a day shift, and again, I'm speaking specifically to behavioral health technicians and registry nurses. If we need 100, right now the hospital is able to supply 95. So we're staffing 95% to our acuity levels or to our need. But that does require a good number of the registry staff that you are referring to. So yes, I absolutely am committed to bringing more full-time employees into the facility. I gotta be honest, they're just not out there. Or if they are, we just can't compete with the private sector. Valleywise is offering sign-on bonuses of $15,000 for these individuals. And we just don't have the flexibility to match that kind of, bonuses, unfortunately.
So do you think that the legislation that passed last year to try to pay back student loans is helping, or you haven't seen a big help from that?
So I think, Lori, it's definitely helped with retention. I can't say that it's helped with recruitment, unfortunately, because it has a specific commitment criteria where, you know, we will give you X amount of money over a certain amount of time. So if you're already with us, you know, that's fantastic. But if you are not yet with us, it's not necessarily like a bite to definitely say, I'm gonna pick the state hospital over this. And that may be because of the fact that people, you know, they need to eat. So their immediate salary is the most important thing, or they need to pay their rent. So their immediate salary is the most important thing at this point. And they're not necessarily thinking, hey, this is a great benefit for me that the state hospital is able to pay me. I believe the legislation allows to pay for up to $75,000 towards student loans. They may not be thinking that long term. They're trying to meet their immediate need. So retention has been helpful. Recruitment, not so sure at this point.
It would be maybe advantageous to hit the nursing schools.
If
someone has student debt, that would be something that may be an attractive.
Yes, that's a fantastic point. And I think that the committee is aware that we we have nursing rotations at the hospital where nursing students come in as part of their curriculum or their clinicals, to get exposure to psychiatric facilities, as well as they do some hours with us, and then they go to the ER, and then they may do labor and delivery, and, you know, so on and so forth. It's very, and I like to meet with them when they're on campus. I kind of pull them aside. Hi, how you doing? I'm Mike. And just kind of pick their brains. I got to be honest, it's very rare for them to say that they have any interest going into psych or mm-hmm. psychiatric nursing. Some of them, they mainly want labor and delivery, or they want ER. Those are the two kind of big ones. Once in a while, you get somebody who's like, yeah, this is, you know, psych is very interesting to me, but it's just, I don't know if it's something at the nursing schools where it's just not kind of ingrained at that level, that psych is a possible career path for them. So I'm not entirely sure. If you or anybody on the committee has any ideas, I think that'd be fantastic. I'd love to dig deeper into that.
I'll ask around if I'm over at ASU with the head of nursing.
Okay.
Okay.
This is Dee. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So as a nurse myself, I can tell you that I think a lot of the students are a little wary of, you know, going into psych nursing. They don't really know what to expect. I personally myself have done some and I enjoyed it, but I don't know that everybody else does. And I think it's something that, because we actually have a nursing student working for us currently, and she was a little scared being there. So I think that's part of the issue. And I don't know how you really move past that, but that's just a perspective.
No, I think you're totally right, Dee. And I think exposure to the environment is probably paramount to kind of knocking down those stigmas about what a psych hospital is like or what going into psych nursing, the rewards of doing so. But it's just, I think it's going to be a generational kind of issue that we have to work collectively to stamp down.
Yeah, not quite as glamorous as some of the other stuff, but I certainly did plenty of it. I worked with the youth and I also worked with the adult folks. And so I really enjoyed it. And I did that in addition to my full-time job at the time. So, but I'm not, I guess, I don't know how you make it more attractive, but sorry, that's it.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of shows about ER and they're on TV and they're in films. And you don't see many that have psychiatric.
Well, the ER is not so glamorous either, as your husband would know.
I know. Yeah. I mean, but
it's very.
They somehow make it glamorous. Yeah.
Yeah.
For those that worked in the ER, it's not always picnics and parades, right? It can be hectic there too. And they can have a lot of abusive patients coming in. But I'm not sure. Let me see what else my notes had. Oh, okay. Legislative update, SB 1710, which was aiming for removing the cap on Maricopa County so that up to the amount of funded beds, people could be admitted regardless of where they came from. That did not pass. Also, there was the second part of that was governance, and the request in that bill was to have independent governance, not from us, but from an agency, a government agency, so someone else, and that failed as well. So that's it on legislative update. Is there anything else before we go to public comment?
Lori?
Yes?
I think you mentioned something about concessions and people hoarding food. How is the hospital handling that?
Well, we had requests or comments that the hospital is trying to limit what patients can have because of some hoarding behavior, and they've taken steps to try to mitigate that because it's not only behavior that can result in people exploiting others for money, but it can also create a hygiene situation that is not safe for the employees.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure.
Are you still on the call, Mike?
I'm here. I'm sorry. I'm having a hard time hearing you though.
Yeah. Okay. Hold on a minute. I was just wondering, are you aware of the situation and what steps the hospital has taken to keep complaints from your clients that they're not able to freely use the machines because of the situation.
Okay, so the middle part of your question broke up, but I caught the very tail end about the machines. So so here is kind of the scenario, and if I don't know the full situation, I apologize. But we did get some complaints slash concerns mentioned by the patients about the way that we're limiting what they can buy in the vending machines. And the reason that we have done that is because what ends up happening, I think that's Chuck. If it's not, I apologize. What happens, Chuck, is that the patients, some patients, not all of them, will go to the machine and they will buy excessive amounts of bags of chips, snack items, so on and so forth. And then the way that we have the mall times kind of segregated, if unit A goes to the mall, a couple of patients kind of hoard the machine, then when unit B goes out, the machine is almost empty. So that's our justification for kind of limiting what they can buy. I believe they asked for two items per person or per patient at a time. But that was the kind of genesis behind that requirement, was to make sure that there was enough food items in the machines so that all the patients, if they wanted to go out and get something, that it was less likely that they would walk up into a empty machine. And our vending service company, they do restock that machine or those machines several times per week. And the machine, there's one, two, I believe there's three snack machines on the forensic hospital mall. And those are three very, what they call, they're very high volume machines. So as soon as they get filled, they're being depleted pretty rapidly. But that's the reason behind that, Chuck.
Okay, thank you, Mike. I appreciate it.
No problem.
No. Have the machines, are they still on money? I know one.
They do. So they do both, Lori. They'll take cash. And then I think we have a few patients that may have their own debit cards. They can use those.
Okay. I know that the vending machines are always big. That and the cafe on the civil side were.
Yeah.
Two.
Yeah.
That
we
and the bank.
Yeah, we are. We have no timeline or time frame for this, but we are looking at potential options for down the road, moving the hospital towards more of a cashless payment system where we're not having to, you know, have patients with a bunch of money on them. I don't know if that'd be something where they have like a specific code that they would use at the vending machine that then taps into their account and then automatically withdraws, or if they have like you know, like a wristband with an RFID on it that they can go walk up to the machine, scan it, and then it'll deduct from their account automatically. But we are looking to try to get in away from cash in the long future from now.
Okay. Well, thank you. So anything else from the committee before we go to public comment?
I would like to make a couple comments. So I've had patients complain to me about the vending machine situation too, when they wanted me to bring it up at IOC. Is there any way possible that we can at least increase the amount of snacks instead of two snacks and two sodas per day? Can it be two snacks and two sodas per pop run? Just because there's some patients that's what they like to spend their money on. And so they've asked me to see if we can have some more wiggle room with that, if we can do two snacks and two sodas per pop run.
So how much would that be then, Kay? Is there two pop runs a day or?
Yeah, two pop runs a day.
Okay, let me talk to nursing about that. I mean, I'm unofficially okay with that, but I don't want to get into a situation where you know, it's one thing for patients to buy it. It's another thing for them to eat it. So if they're hoarding, you know, mounds of chips in their room.
Yeah, that's not not what we're looking for. We're just looking for, there's some patients that like to buy like their 2 bags of popcorn on each pop run and have a soda with it. And so now they're getting redirected and told that they can't have it. And, you know, it's just kind of, yeah.
Yeah, let me ask around for that one.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, Lori, I have a question. I don't know if it's appropriate to ask now or if we're going to have executive session. My question about housing.
Housing at Ash or?
Sorry. Well, yeah, placement. This is. I had a question about non-binary and transgender persons, and if the, I could just ask it. You can let me know. So I've been doing a variety of projects looking at trauma-informed design and housing for non-binary and transgender persons. And it made me wonder if the hospital has any policy or protocols when it comes to housing or placement of non-binary or transgender. And so it's just a question that I have.
Top of my head, Melissa, I don't know if we have anything specific. Obviously, we would not have anything that would discriminate against those populations. Are you referring to like having like specific units for those individuals or?
Well, potentially, like actually, you know, how if there's any specific policy, for instance, about how placement might be determined, right? Because like other state facilities has very specific ways of saying whether or not a person, you know, how a person gets placed, whether it's based on how the individual identifies or if it's something else, right? Biological. And then just looking at how individuals, you know, feel safe and comfortable.
At the top of my head, I can't say yes or no to that, unfortunately. To my knowledge, when I've been involved in conversations about this, it's been an individual who is not on forensics or civil. It's in our other unit, so I can't speak specifically to this. But I'm sure definitely if we do have any policies, if the committee asks about them, or does, you know, the voting procedures, we could definitely supply them. I think that's how this works.
Yeah. You'd be happy to know though that on the Bauer project, which will be on the Ash campus, it won't be run by Ash, but there is transgender, non-binary showers, bathrooms, and sleeping quarters for those that identify differently. So I think new builds are definitely going in that direction. And I'm sure that's what Melissa is facing as an architect currently in design.
Yeah, and then I know it can be challenging in existing facilities, right, that aren't necessarily set up for that, and that's part of my question too. Doesn't sound like there's been any issues, but
no. Think now that Lori added that part about the Bauer Park project, I think that obviously safety is our paramount concern. So if we did have an individual in that kind of situation that did not feel safe, you know, we do have a select number of individual rooms where they would have their own bedroom. Mm-hmm. On the civil campus, that individual may also have their own bathroom or their own toilet and sink mm-hmm. attached to that room. So I think we have some room to kind of navigate the issue. But to my knowledge, it has not come up.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else before we go to public comment?
Yeah,
Kerstin. Okay, so again, would you like your name in the minutes?
Can you hear me, ma'am?
I could hear you. If you want your name in the minutes, you should repeat.
Sure. It's Mr. Charles Edmar.
Okay.
Yeah, I have an addendum. There's only two snack machines on the forensic mall at this time.
I'm just, we're not allowed to comment on public comments, so it's your turn to speak and tell us what you'd like.
Yeah, I spoke with the COO about a month and a half ago about expanding the gym, which is in Building 8. And she said, that's great. She said, the only problem is finding funding for that. So I'd be happy to work with anybody as a team to get that going. We can't fit a basketball rink in there. It's too small. So yeah, this is a Charles Edmark. I've got a voicemail number. It's 928-351-7679. Call anytime and let me know what your best day of time is, and we'll set up a at least a telephone conference. I'm with Van Platinum and Van Platinum also. I'm a patient here on Pinion.
Okay. Thank you, Charles.
Well, thank you all. Continued success.
Hello. Yes, this is Roger Woodville from Stable Unit.
Want your name in the minutes?
Yes, I do. Is that a... okay. It's one of those. Okay. It's because we're on the speakerphone and you're talking back to me. Okay. I'm ready. Okay.
If the other unit was mute, you may not get as much feedback.
If I do what?
No, you can't mute it because you need to speak.
No, we can't mute it because we have to speak.
No, the other units that are on.
Oh, hey, the other units, please mute your mics. Edmark, please.
Yeah, I can hear and talk, and Mr. Edmark.
Would you please mute your mic? I can't speak with the thing coming back at me. Okay. Oh, man, I hope this didn't use any of my minutes. Oh, my God. There's so many stressors in this place. It's unbelievable. I don't need another stressor like this. Listen to me. The new forensic guidelines, I don't know how they make this stuff. I don't even know if they had a chief medical officer when they did this, because they had this new guy. I think he's Flower. He's the new med CMO. But they have to have a panel that has to be voted on. It has to be administrative in order to pass these guidelines down, because they treat like rules and make us live by it. There's two of them that they're brand new. They're limiting our purchasing power, right? I think it's a monopoly and securities exchange violation, federal violation to limit our purchasing power. Two sodas a day and two snacks a day. It's pretty bad. I'm going to be writing everybody, including the securities exchange, all the PepsiCo and Coca-Cola and Frito-Lay and everybody else that's involved. I'm going to a canteen vending company. I'm going to have people email them, and I'm going to be writing some letters and drawing up some legal paperwork. Also, and it's against what I was promised in Arizona, a verbal contract legal and binding. It's against my plea agreement. The second thing is they changed the meal time to be eaten within a half an hour after they're served. Like, if they stick to that, that's like prison time. That's what they do in the prison. We have constitutional rights here. We have liberty interest, the right to liberty interest, and the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And it certainly doesn't make me happy. It's not the pursuit of happiness. And I believe it's against our liberty interest. It's a deficiency of the hospital. It's borderline illegal. I wish somebody would do something about this and have them revise this and have it actually voted upon and go through legislation like it's supposed to, if they're going to treat this like a rule. That's about it for now. There's so many other things, but I'm going to take some legal action and be calling and emailing and maybe start some petitions against this and let all these companies know. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Do we have anyone else from the public that would like to make public comment?
A quick addendum. There's 2/5 of an acre due south of our current quote gymnasium that we can expand into. It's not being used by other entities. Thank you all.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else from the public that would like to make a comment? Okay, with nothing, no one speaking up, do I have a motion to adjourn?
Motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
So we'll move to adjournment and hopefully we'll be able to visit the patients either telephonically, Zoom wise, or in person as soon as we get people that are available. But thank you guys.
Thank you.
Good night, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good night. Good night.
You too. Thank you. Bye.